working? Can you hear me? Okay. Well, I got a text at about 6:30 this morning. Pastor John said he was really sick. He said, "I'm so sick, I can't stop coughing." So pray for him. That's not fun. Coughs are not fun. And so I have, on pretty short notice, tried to get a sermon ready. I felt like I knew pretty quickly what God wanted me to talk about. I usually have more on my mind than I think he has on his in some ways. No, of course. He's got way more on his mind than I do, but I want to do more than my appointed lot sometimes, I guess. I want to cover more than I think, I want to cover more than I can cover. Interestingly enough, I've been trying to spend some time in My Most for His Highest recently, morning devotional. I've been trying to get in it and said, well, I'm gonna see what Oswald Chambers had to say for this day, which interestingly enough was preach the word. So that was pretty interesting. John has been teaching through Joshua. I think it's John's intent to go into Judges because of the very relevant things that it has to say to our time. And one of the things about that is, if you know the story of Joshua and Judges, particularly Judges, but it begins in Joshua, by the end of the book of Judges, a Israelite is difficult to distinguish from a Canaanite. There had been such a level of compromise with the world, and in their context, that was the Canaanites and their religious practices, that a person who was part of the covenant people of God was not easy to distinguish. They were living the same ways, thinking the same ways. There was acknowledgement of the Lord, but mixed in with a bunch of garbage. And very, very similar to our time. Still references to the Lord, but often mixed in with lots of ungodly and worldly things. And what I felt like I should talk about is the kings of Israel. My ambition was to talk about a short statement on every king of Israel, and then I've realized that's not going to happen. I'm not going to be able to do that. But we are going to try to glean some things from the lives of the kings of Israel. Now, one of the things to understand about the way that God has revealed himself to us. So we live in a world where, at a very superficial level, God doesn't exist. God does not reveal himself visibly, audibly, normally. Okay, right? So the Bible says that we walk by faith, not by sight, and God has ordained the world to be this way. It's a world where sinners can have their wish, in a sense, to live life as if God is not real. And God allows them to do that. Just like apparently God did not manifest his presence at the tree in the Garden of Eden, right? He wasn't sitting there looking at Adam, are you going to do this? You know, God made himself not apparent. Later, he walked in the garden in the cool of the day and gave Adam the opportunity to confess his sin. But God allows us to exist, to live our life in the very superficial appearance that God's not real and that he's not here. And so now the world is deeply in the throes of that, so deep that people say, how could there be a good God? How could a good God let this kind of world exist with the kind of things that happen in this world? I was listening to a thing on C.S. Lewis last night, and he was an atheist for part of his life. And he said, how could God, by any standard that we could measure, be called good? So this is the kind of reproaches that are thrown against God on a daily basis. God said, my name every day continually is blasphemed. Okay? So that's the world we live in. People delighted with the idea that God doesn't exist, people angry with God for what he allows to happen. All sorts of things are happening. But what is happening? Why is God doing it this way? Why is the world set up the way it is? Well, one of the things we can say is, doesn't necessarily matter to see the manifest presence of God, does it? Satan did, and he still chose to rebel against God. Adam and Eve, at least Adam knew the revealed presence of God, and he chose to rebel against God. So seeing the existence of God is not a deciding factor in whether you're going to follow God or not, very clearly from the Bible. And of course, Jesus came to earth, revealed himself by multitudes of miracles, by all these things, and was not generally received. Okay, he was popular for periods of time when he was giving people what they wanted. And then ultimately, the call of Christ was something people were not interested in. And so that truth that God is revealing himself to us in different ways, and even not revealing himself to us in different ways, all has a purpose, and it's designed. But the overall purpose is God is seeking for people to be reconciled with him and inviting us to realize it's more an issue of your heart than your mind. The mind is important. I love the study of the mind so much that it's affected my own spiritual life negatively. It's very easy for me to get off on apologetic points. And I love that. I love studying the Bible for the intellectual. I love the fruits of wisdom, you know, that when it says in Proverbs that wisdom says that her delights were with the sons of men, I'm like, yeah, you know, I love it. I love understanding things about God. But at the end of the day, it doesn't much matter, does it, if you don't love God? It just doesn't matter what you know if you don't love God. If I speak with the tongues of men and of angels and have not love, I'm become a sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and understand all wisdom and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so that I can remove mountains and have not love, I'm nothing. If I bestow all my goods to feed the poor and deliver my body to be burned and I have not love, I'm nothing. And the first commandment is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And then love your neighbors yourself. So knowledge is great. And it's a great tool in the right hands, in the right hands, and the most especially in the right heart. Knowledge with the wrong heart is just dangerous. Okay? It just makes you better at doing wrong. And so that God is revealing to us that the real issue is the state of your heart. It's God is letting it play out for us. Do you want God to not be real? Or do you want him to be real? Will you love God for who he is or for who you want him to be? I mean, and that's really what it comes down to. And so, as you look at the history, so at a very superficial level, just like God doesn't exist, at a very superficial level, the Old Testament is a litany of failures. It's just, why did God ever do this? Why did he even found the nation of Israel? I mean, they end up being carried away captive. I mean, that's the story. You know, Israel, after a litany of sin, he delivers from slavery. They're constantly rebellious. He takes them into the promised land. They don't drive out the Canaanites like God tells them to do. They insist on having a king when it's not God's purpose at that time to give them a king. Then when they get kings, the kings often, more often than not, lead them into evil. And then finally, the nation is carried away captive. And that's the Old Testament. Okay? I mean, so what is the point of God doing this? And there's, like God, there's things operating at multiple levels, okay? There's lots of reasons why God is doing it that way. One of the ways of understanding the Old Testament and the Old Testament making sense to you is this. God is setting things up to show your need for Christ. That's what it is. God is setting everything up to show you, you have no prophet that can save you. No priest that can save you. No king that can save you. You have no sacrifice for sin that can save you. The Old Testament sets up every one of those ideas. The idea of the prophet, the man who speaks to you from God. The idea of the priest, the man that represents you before God. The idea of the king, the one who rules over you in God's place. The idea of the sacrifice, the one who can atone for your sins before God. And the Old Testament brings up the idea of each one of those things and gives you examples of them and shows you what failures they all are. And so the Old Testament is set up to prove to you that people individually and corporately are failures. I mean, and that's the message. For all have sinned and come short of the glory of God, and that God, through Christ, saves us. So that, if you want to understand all the problems, the basic problematic nature of the Old Testament is just meant to show you how much you need Christ. That's what it's for. All right, but it also, so as we look at the history of the kings, there's a lot of negative stuff. A lot of things that, like, man, what in the world? Why am I hearing about the life of this guy, you know? So it's to look at the life of the kings at one level is to look at the need for Christ to come. Good kings and bad kings. Both of them show you the need for Christ to come. But they also serve as examples for us. They do. So you can get the message, the Christ-centered message, that the kings are pointing you to your need for Christ and for everyone's need for Christ. But also, you can glean personal examples from the lives of the kings. You can do that too. I've heard people say, people teach the Bible in a very self-focused way in our time, very self-help kind of way that's wrong. So, like, people use this example. Most people, when they teach the story of David and Goliath, say, see how David trusted in God? You can beat the giants in your life by trusting in God too. And so some people are very critical of that and say, the story of David and Goliath is not about that. It's about how David is a type of Christ, and he is the representative for Israel, goes out and beats the giant that no one else can beat. It's not either or. It's both. Okay? That's true. David is a type of Christ, and he did go beat the giant none of us can beat. He did it as a seemingly weak human being. He beat the power of sin and darkness and the devil as a seemingly weak human being, seemingly impossible task. Christ is the one that did that for us. That's true. And that's the fundamental message we always need to keep in mind, that the Bible is always establishing our need for Jesus. But there is a personal application in that story as well. We follow Christ as our example. We're to walk in his steps. So he did beat the giant none of us could beat, but we're called to follow that example too. So we can get a personal application. See how David trusted God and God, yeah, that applies to us too, and applies to Christ even more. Okay? So I think it's like that with the life of the kings. We can look at the kings and say, boy, we just need Jesus. That's what these kings show us, and that's true. But we can also learn examples of God's teaching for us for our personal lives by looking at the life of the kings. So with whatever time we have, and we're gonna look at the lives of some of these kings. I'm not planning on spending a lot of time on any one king, but to try to go through and just pull out some things from the lives of these kings that I hope will be helpful. So the first king of Israel is Saul. Now, if you remember the story, remember the context of this, God had been governing the people through judges. And the judges, I guess you would say, would be similar. It's almost like they were in the likeness of Joshua. Joshua wasn't a king. Joshua was a military leader who would just deal with problems as necessary. In other words, he didn't sit on a throne telling everybody what to do. It's like, I'm here to lead you as far as accomplishing this purpose in God's life. But other than that, you do your thing. I was listening to a guy recently who said he called the appointment of Saul of the kings the second fall of man. Now that's probably an overstatement. But the point he was trying to illustrate was this. People were insisting on having a king, and God said, they're not rejecting. Samuel was upset about it. The prophet Samuel was upset about it. And God said to Samuel, they're not rejecting you. They're rejecting me as king over them. See, people insisting on a strong human leader, somebody I can get behind, put all my confidence in. This is the guy I want, some human being to deliver me. That's not the Lord. I mean, that's that. So they were wanting. That there is something essentially wrong. You know what? It's not even contrary to God's purpose that he ultimately intends for them to have a king. he himself is going to reign through a human being in Jesus Christ, right? Jesus is the king, the human being who comes. I mean, that's part of the purpose of God, but with human beings, it gets twisted. We don't really want to believe in this God sight unseen. We want some physical leader we can put all of our confidence in. And so that's the context in which Saul is made king. And God, you want a king? Okay, I'm going to pick you one. The tallest, most handsome man in Israel. That's who they got. The tallest, most handsome man. That's what it actually says. He had a son named Saul, a young and a handsome one. And there was not a man among the sons of Israel more handsome than he, being taller than any of the people from his shoulder and upward. So this guy is literally head and shoulders above the rest, right? I mean, the old statement. Okay, so God picked someone that was the epitome of human confidence. You want a big, strong, good-looking man to lead you. All right, I got the guy. All right, so God picked out Saul to be the leader of the people. Now, Saul is a very interesting. As we go through the last of the Kings, I want to go ahead and say this. Life is so complicated, isn't it? It's like Job's friends. I know I refer to that a lot, but boy, they had a really simple theology. If you do right, God rewards you. And if you do wrong, God punishes you. Just see how simple that is? See how that works? No, you know, it just makes life easy. Only it's not always immediately true. It's true in the ultimate sense. In fact, Job said, who doesn't know that? I know that. But that's not what's happening right now. That's not what's going on right now. And see, Job is a type of Christ, a type of the most righteous person suffering greater than other people. That's what part of what I just love that line in Job where he says, oh that my life basically was inscribed with an iron pen, that it couldn't be forgotten. It's like, wish granted. People have been hearing about the story of Job now for thousands of years. You got it, buddy. And not only that, you got to be a prefigure of Christ. So life is complicated, and all the kings, maybe that's an overstatement, generally speaking, they're complicated figures. Some of the godly ones are going to do some really ungodly things. Some of the ungodly ones are going to sound like a righteous guy at points. And life's complicated like that, isn't it? But that's the way it is. That no person is a perfect example of righteousness, even people who really know the Lord. And even the most wicked of people can look good in some context. You know, they look good sometimes. So it's complicated, and Saul is complicated. He seems very humble. He didn't want to be king. When they did the thing to appoint him king, he's hiding in the stuff. Or, you know, like he found some, everybody's gathered together in Israel. They know God's going to give them the king they've been asking for, and Saul is hiding. Okay, so he's not self-confident at the beginning, and that's what Samuel tells him. He said, "When you were little in your sight, God had made you basically the head over Israel." So the interesting thing about Saul is he didn't want to become king, apparently for fear of people. And then when he became king, he didn't want to give it up, no matter what. Even if God said, "I'm taking this from you." See, what would have been the logical thing for a godly person to do if God said, "You're not going to be king anymore"? It's like, okay, Lord, I understand. I really blew it. I really sinned. How are we going to do this transition? I mean, I humble myself before you. Let's do this. I didn't have the courage. And then he said, you know, it happened in the context of he didn't fully destroy the Amalekites like he was supposed to, and all their goods. And he took the spoil. He said, because I feared the people. See, Saul is driven by the fear of man. That's how Saul operates. That's what he goes off of. It's not really ultimately God that's driving Saul's life. It's the opinion of other people. That's how he's functioning. And the Bible says the fear of man brings a snare. Okay? So Saul has got aspects of him that seem good. Saul's scary. It says when Saul turned away from Samuel that God gave him another heart. And you're going, whoa, what is that? Is he saved? What does it mean to have another heart? I mean, that's what we think of when we hear you have another heart. So something, some kind of spiritual transaction happened in Saul He became a leader with some empowering from God, but Saul's scary. In fact, it says, when this first happened, I'll just read this section of it to you. "And it happened when he had turned his back to go from Samuel, God changed him with another heart. And all those signs came on that day." I haven't gone into that, and so I'll skip some things. But Saul ends up prophesying among these other prophets who are coming down. Saul prophesies among them, and the people said to one another, "What is this that has happened to the son of Kish? Is Saul also among the prophets?" And a man from there answered and said, "And who is their father?" Therefore it became a proverb, "Is Saul also among the prophets?" Okay, so this is an interesting thing. Saul's life at this point becomes a proverb. Is Saul a prophet too? I mean, God's appointed him, you know, and so this one guy who observes this says, "Well, you know, who's the father of those prophets?" So in other words, just because you're a prophet, does that mean your father was a prophet? Not necessarily, okay? And if you're a prophet, does that mean your son will be one? Not necessarily, okay? So it becomes proverbial in that sense that God chooses a person based on whatever God's purpose is for that person's life, not based on his family lineage, you know? So Saul's life becomes proverbial in that sense. Is Saul among the prophets? So in other words, a prophet could come from anywhere. It's like Ratatouille, right? A good cook can come from anywhere, sorry. Okay, so a prophet can come from anywhere. So Saul's life is proverbial in that sense, but like some of the things God does, it's like, oh, that's used in more than one area. And so in another place, toward the end of Saul's life and career, is it toward the end? I'm sorry. Well, at one point, after Saul has gotten much more rebellious, has gotten much more jealous of David, and has gone to try to kill David, he ends up prophesying naked before Samuel and Saul. I won't go into the story, but it's like he is just humiliated by God for trying to go do this. He actually strips off all his clothes and lays down and prophesies naked. It was his purpose to go there and kill David. But instead, he ends up prophesying naked, laying on the ground before Samuel and David. So God put his face in the dust and shamed him because of what he was trying to do. And if I remember correctly, you're going to have to give me some grace. I couldn't research all this. I'm just going to have to partly go off on memory. Okay, I got some of it researched, some of it not. But as I remember it, the proverb is said again, "Is Saul among the prophets?" And it becomes a deeper question. You know, Jesus said to the Israelites, basically, I can't remember how he puts it, but you're going to see Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and all the prophets in the kingdom of heaven and yourselves not there. He was saying that to Israelites, making them recognize just because you're a Jew is not going to cut it. Yes, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and the prophets are in the kingdom of heaven. That doesn't mean you will be. And Saul's life is like that. Is Saul in heaven or is he in hell? I don't know. There's some things about Saul's life that you think, well, maybe he was just a really, really backslidden believer. You know, maybe this guy really knew the Lord. I could easily believe either one. I mean, neither one would come as a shock to me. People like Samson are apparently in heaven, and me, I wouldn't think you'd go to heaven, but I guess so. You know, he's in Hebrews chapter 11 in the hall of faith. He never seemed to do one thing for the glory of God for its own sake. It was all self-directed kind of stuff. Even at the end, "Let me be avenged of my two eyes." You know, did he ever fight the enemies of God just because they were the enemies of God? Not that I can see. But anyway, he did have a certain kind of faith in God. And so we're presented in the Bible with very flawed examples. And of course, everybody's really flawed if we know them. So people that go to heaven, it's not because they deserve it. It's never because they deserve it. And there's really people who go to hell. And is Saul among those prophets that are sitting at the table of the kingdom of heaven? Is Saul among the prophets? I don't know. I'll find out. Okay, but I don't know. And that's one of the interesting things about the life of Saul. And so Saul is this disturbing person. You don't want to be like Saul. He lived based, his fatal flaw was the fear of man. And he was driven to, to jealousy over David, and he ends up killing himself on the battlefield. That's the end of Saul. I said I wasn't going to spend too much time. Some kings, I guess I will. So, spend a little bit. I probably will spend some more time on some of these early characters, early figures. Sorry. I have one of those deals where, if you let your computer lie dormant. So, Saul, at a literary level, David and Saul, if I remember correctly, would be called foils. Okay, so they're like, they're contrast to each other. And so, God is a brilliant author. Okay, that's my thing. I majored in literature, and it's like, man, this is cool. Okay, I studied this stuff in other writers, only this is written over centuries by different people to tell one story. This is cool. Okay, there's nothing like this in the whole world that shows God is prophesying the future, creating a book with one thematic, with one basic thematic thing that fits together like a story. You rip the New Testament out, it's like ripping out the last chapter. It's like, no, you can't do that. So God wrote this story, and it's got real people, but their lives are actually like characters who mean something. So Saul is like this embodiment of fleshly power, okay? And it shows the dramatic failure of that fleshly power. So David is sort of the opposite of him. Not in every respect. It says that David actually is handsome too, okay? But when Samuel was sent to pick out a king from the sons of Jesse, and Eliab comes in, the firstborn, it's like, man, okay, there's a man, here we go. Surely the Lord's anointed is before him. And God said this to Samuel: do not look on his appearance or on the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. For the Lord sees not as man sees. Man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart. And that's it. Okay, so you can see that God is like saying, hey, pick this big dude, you know. So people wanted somebody they could fleshly trust in, and they got him. But now we're down to picking the real king. Don't look at what he looks like on the outside, because the Lord looks on the heart. That's what God is after. And so, that is the statement that's given over David's life. A lot of y'all know the story of David. I can't talk about it. I mean, probably more time is spent on David than any other king of Israel. David is like one of the preeminent types of Christ in the Old Testament, betrayed by a close friend. Jesus was betrayed by a close friend. There's these different aspects of David's life and what David represents in his life that are embodied by Christ. Now, we know that David had a horrible season of transgression in his life over Bathsheba and killing her husband Uriah. Okay? But one of the ways that David's life is summarized in 2 Chronicles, that basically, 2 Chronicles, I'm sorry, I can't remember where, but anyway, David's life is summarized by saying that he followed the Lord basically with all of his heart all the days of his life, except in the matter of Uriah the Hittite. It wasn't the only sin David ever committed, but it was the most flagrant transgression. So even David, the man after God's own heart, is not safe from sin. And there's a big message for that. You can be a real believer. You are not safe from very serious and harmful sin. And don't ever consider yourself to be so until you're in heaven. Okay? You are not safe from sin. I'm not telling you to live in fear. I'm just saying, hey, have some sensible fear. Understand, David had gone through all that hardship under Saul and had been faithful to God under very difficult circumstances. And then when things got easy is actually when David transgressed. And there's something to that. Sometimes we're better off when things are hard than when things are easy. When things are easy, sometimes we let our guard down and we think everything's safe and everything's okay. And everything wasn't safe and it wasn't okay. Satan was after David. He was after him. He was one of probably the few people on earth that got Satan's personal attention. The king of God's chosen people. Not a little flunky demon. the king of the demons is after him. Okay, waiting. And none of us probably are ever going to warrant that in our lives to have the devil himself. But we all get demons assigned to us. And they're looking for a way to cause you to have a major fall, a major transgression. There are little ones that have to take that one and get it. But they're after you. And we know from a certain passage that Satan was specifically after David. He was after Peter. Peter was close to Jesus, and Satan's after Jesus, and you're standing beside him. You're on the list. You're a target. We can't go into everything about David's life other than he's so famous. But as you look at the prophets, it's an interesting thing. It says, "And I will set up over," this is in Ezekiel chapter 34, "and I will set up over them one shepherd, my servant David, and he shall feed them. He shall feed them and be their shepherd." So Ezekiel, I think, is, if I remember correctly, is probably prophesying roughly 600 years before Jesus. And so David's roughly 900 to 1,000 years before Jesus. So this is like 300 years after David's dead. Ezekiel's saying David's going to be the king of Israel, okay? And although David, of course, we know is alive in the presence of God and may have some sort of rulership authority too. I'm not going to get into those things deeply. I don't understand them myself. I know that Jesus told the disciples, "You'll sit on 12 thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel." It's like, okay, I guess humans get some things deferred to them in the heavenly kingdom. I don't know how that works. So David may rule in some sense, but I don't think all those prophecies about David ruling are actually meant to be taken literally as David. Just like, and I'm going to give you, there's some scriptural basis for that. Jesus was saying, you know, the disciples asked Jesus, you know, why did the scribes say that Elijah must come first? In other words, Elijah has to come before the Messiah comes. And Jesus said, "Elijah truly comes first and restores all things. But I say to you that Elijah has already come and they did not know him." And the Gospels comment on that and said, this he spoke of John the Baptist. Okay, so see, sometimes the Bible is being spiritual or figurative. It's like, it's not literally Elijah. John the Baptist was the representative of the prophets that was like Elijah. Okay? And so when it talks about David being the eternal king, it's Christ. Christ is the son of David. He's the one who is the fulfillment of what David was supposed to be. Now, David's still there and having a great time taking part, okay? But it's ultimately about Christ. So, let's go on to Solomon. So, David has a son, Solomon. The typology is just awesome here, okay? So, David wants to build God a temple, to build God's house. And God says to Solomon, "You're not going to build my house. You're a man of blood. You've shed a lot of blood on me before the earth. Before me on the earth. You're going to have a son, and he's going to be a man of peace. He will build my house." Now, that literally became true that Solomon built the physical temple of the Lord. And it literally became true that Solomon turned to idolatry, built other pagan temples. And so this great hope that I guess the immediate successor to David might be the Messiah was, okay, that all went to the ground. Definitely, he's not the Messiah. Okay, Solomon is not the Messiah. Solomon is another one of those scary figures. Now, I think Solomon's in heaven, but it would be because of God's grace and because that maybe books like Ecclesiastes show that he repented, you know, that he had come to an understanding. It's kind of almost hard to imagine the guy who wrote Proverbs, the guy who wrote Ecclesiastes, the guy who wrote the Song of Solomon being in hell, you know, that God had spoken this much through him. But Solomon's life is definitely a warning, right? Once again, prosperity is dangerous. I'm not saying you shouldn't be prosperous. Lots of godly people have been, and lots of godly people have not been. That's not the issue. But Solomon, it says of Solomon, when he was born, the Lord loved him. It says of Solomon later, Solomon loved the Lord, walking in the statutes of David his father. So God loved Solomon, Solomon loved God. Solomon finished his course very poorly, to say the least. Okay? To say the least, Solomon finished his course and did so much damage in his life. Did a lot of wonderful things, gave us parts of the scripture, and also set Israel on the course of national destruction. Well, that's pretty stark, pretty stark contrast, isn't it? Somebody to actually write part of the Bible and then to set Israel on a destruction course of idolatry. That's what he did. So life is complicated. Our lives are complicated. And what the point of this is to, there's encouraging people's lives, by the way. But, you know, David's life is basically encouraging. You know, it just lets you know that if you had a major sin, you can still go on. That cost David. That sin cost David. When he's crying and saying, "Absalom, my son, would God I had died for thee." He knew, I caused this. Now, he made his choices. Absalom chose his own course in one sense, but David's life set that in motion, and the pain of it was almost unbearable. He knew how destructive his sins had been in the life of Absalom. And God said, I'm going to raise up trouble, I can't remember how he puts it, from your own house. And David had to watch it happen. And David was wishing, I wish I had just died instead of this happening. So that's a serious, serious thing. But David's life, I mean, David is rejoicing in the Lord at the end of his life. We have to accept the consequences of our sins. Hey, we've all got that. And if the things that we've, the damage that we've caused, we just have to, the Judas solution is not the right solution. I'll just kill myself. That's not the right solution. Not the right solution to be bitter for the rest of your life. The only right solution is to say, I did wrong. I repent before God, and God help me to live the rest of my life the way I should. That's all. That's the only right way. And so, Solomon, you know, it came a place in Solomon's life where he was asked by God, ask me for anything. Ask me for anything. Whoa. So, I mean, God's not a genie. I mean, you know, ultimate power here. Ask me for something. And Solomon said, give me wisdom. And God was pleased. Hey, you didn't ask for long life, the life of your enemies. You didn't ask for great riches for yourself. I'm going to give you all that. Just because you asked for wisdom, I'm going to give you all that. And then you got to look at Solomon's life and go, but, well, he asked for wisdom, but he did some really foolish, stupid stuff. He did some really foolish things. And so this is what I get out of that. Ask God to love him. Ask God to love him and trust him. If you love God, you're going to obey God. If you really, truly trust God, you're going to follow him. It's one thing to know the right answer, and it's another thing to do it, kind of like we talked about earlier. All right? Knowledge is wonderful, but it's not the deepest thing. The deepest thing is to love what's good, and that ultimately means loving God. So, Rehoboam. Rehoboam was king after Solomon. God was going to split the kingdom. We're not even going to deal with any of the kings of Israel, really. We're just about done dealing with these. But Rehoboam, kind of interesting guy. He's the guy that listened to the young men instead of the old men. I guess y'all might remember that story. But the people said, hey, Solomon made our yoke heavy. King Rehoboam, make our yoke lighter. Don't put as much stuff on us as Solomon was. And so Rehoboam asked the old men, that were with Solomon, how should I answer these people? And he said, the old man said, look, if you'll be a servant to these people, they're going to be your servant forever. If you try to take care of these people and do, you know, then they're going to serve you. But the young men said, "No, you show them what a man you are." Okay? You double down. He's like, and so Rehoboam made this boast. My little finger is thicker than my father's thighs, or waist, or translated possibly different ways. But in other words, oh, my father didn't hold a candle to who I'm going to be. Well, it actually turned out that it was really bad to listen to these young men's advice. Okay? And he didn't turn out to be hardly a shadow of the king of his father, good or bad. Okay? So Solomon married 1,000 wives, 700 wives, 300 concubines. That was a big mistake. And God had specifically said not to multiply wives, which actually means don't have more than one. But he radically, radically transgressed that. So Rehoboam had 18 wives and 60 concubines. His little finger's not really measuring, even up to the wrong things that Solomon did, his little finger's really not measuring up to his dad. And so he's a big boaster, but it's not true. And his kingdom saw a lot of the actual deterioration physically of the kingdom of Israel, the split into two kingdoms. Shishak, the king of Egypt, came up and took the gold shields, if I remember right, took the gold shields that Solomon made. So his kingdom didn't hold a candle to his father's kingdom. And so when you're boasting, you just need to realize you're putting yourself up in a position to really lose and fall. Not a good thing to do. Now, the next king was Abijah or Abijam. It's said either way. There's a really interesting thing there. If you read the account of him in 2 Chronicles, he sounds like a pretty righteous dude. There's a little bit of historical revision. You know, you listen to the way he puts some things, like, oh, that's not quite right. You know, but he basically tells the evil king of Israel, hey, you know, you've appointed these priests from whoever wants to be a priest. We have the sons of Aaron, the Levites are our priests. We're serving the Lord. You guys are serving idols, you know. And it sounds like, oh man, this guy sounds like, and he puts his trust in the Lord, it sounds like, for the battle. And there is a victory. He wins the battle. But the summation of his life is this that's given in 1 Kings chapter 15, verse 3. And he walked in all the sins that his father did before him. And his heart, that's Rehoboam, and his heart was not true, not wholly true to the Lord his God as the heart of David his father. So he had some godly sounding things and even some godly accomplishments. But the Bible tells us his heart wasn't right. His heart was not wholly true to the Lord his God. And that's a question that each person has to, I don't want you to be looking over your own shoulder in a sense. You know, I mean, some people take things like, oh, I'm not really a believer. So I'm not. That's not the part. It's like if you feel crushed by those things, you need to say, hey, you know, God, just, I want to trust you. Forgive me for all my sins. I know I don't follow you like I should. Help me to do that. And so, but the Bible is warning us, hey, you know, you can serve God with an imperfect heart. You can sound real spiritual, but your heart, you're neglecting fully devoting that to God. And so that's the warning that this king gives us. Asa, I'm going to try to speed up real fast. I know we've got to quit soon. Asa was a very interesting king. So Asa is the one that trusted in God in the face of this million-man army. This million-man army was coming up against Israel. And Asa's like, God, we're putting our trust in you. And God defeats him and does all that. And you're thinking, man, finally a godly king. Boy, things are going to be great under Asa. Then another battle happens. Another threat comes. And he hires the king of Syria. And a prophet comes to him and says, what? So you trusted in the Lord and won this great battle. And then this other guy comes and you hire a pagan king to help you. And the prophet says to him, yet because you, So the prophet says to him, this famous verse, "For the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth to give strong support to those whose heart is blameless toward him." Okay? So it's a great verse. Like, hey, God is looking for someone whose heart is perfect toward him so he can show himself strong. And that's a verse that each one of us, that should be in our mind, man. God's looking for somebody who's wanting to put their trust in, who's putting their trust, whose heart is perfect toward him, to show himself strong on their behalf. So it's not that God's not wanting to do it. There's not very many takers on that, who's wanting to have a heart that's perfect toward God. And instead of repenting at the, and so the prophet said, "You've done foolishly in this. From now on, you will have wars." Okay, since you didn't trust God with this, your wars are going to characterize the rest of your life. And then Asa was angry with the seer and put him in the stocks in prison, for he was enraged with him because of this. And Asa inflicted cruelties on some of the people at the same time. Okay, and so it talks about Asa. Asa, at his last, was severely diseased in his feet, and it makes this comment about Asa. But in his sickness, he did not seek to the physicians. I mean, he did not seek the Lord, but to the physicians. There's nothing wrong with going to the doctor. That's not what this is about. It's just like David fought in the battle, but his trust was in the Lord. It's not wrong to go to the doctor. But Asa very pointedly was not seeking the Lord. He had turned to fleshly solutions for his problems. You hire a pagan king when you need help. You go to the doctor, you don't seek the Lord. So I think there's a place that says of Asa that his heart was perfect with the Lord his God all these days, and you're going, what? What about all this garbage? I think what it means is that Asa was a believer, a believer who finished his course very poorly. Look, and I'm not saying everybody that finishes their course poorly is a believer. I'm just trying to do the best I can of trying to determine what these different statements mean. But I know life is complicated. I know that believers have real faults, and unbelievers sometimes look good. And so God is teaching us through these things, warning us through these things. I think the last one, I really wish I could go on, but we're just going to have to pray and dismiss because it's so late. But I want to get this one out. Maybe sometime if God gives me opportunity, I'll get to go through more of the Kings, because there's really good stuff. Jehoshaphat. Jehoshaphat was the king, a godly king, did so many things, sent people out to teach the word of God in his kingdom. Did all this great stuff. Jehoshaphat, man, he's a good king. He had a terrible, terrible flaw that did not seem very obvious. In fact, might even seem like a spiritual thing, but there's something that's not right with it. He made alliances with King Ahab, the wicked, ungodly king of Israel. And does Jesus reach out to the wicked? Absolutely. Does he go and eat with the sinners? Absolutely. And we can have fellowship with the world in that sense, not true fellowship, but you reach out to people who don't know the Lord. You have relationships with them. I mean, there's things about that, but see, he made no distinction. On more than one occasion, he made a statement like this. When Ahab asked him to go to battle with him, Jehoshaphat said, "I am as you are. My people as your people. We will be with you in the war." I am as you are. No, you're not. Ahab was one of the most ungodly kings Israel had ever seen. He was wicked. And Jehoshaphat was trying to serve, was in many respects doing a good job of serving God. And that's one of the things that a prophet said to him. So a prophet told Jehoshaphat later, "Jehu the son of Hanani, the seer, went out to meet him and said to King Jehoshaphat, 'Should you help the wicked and love those who hate the Lord? Because of this, wrath has gone out against you from the Lord. Nevertheless, some good is found in you, for you destroyed the Ashtaroth out of the land and have set your heart to seek God.'" See, a real believer can really have a heart for God, but affiliate themselves in wrong ways with the lost, with people who hate God. And I'm not saying you shouldn't reach out to people who hate God, but there's such a thing as being unequally yoked with unbelievers. And this was so costly, it can't hardly be imagined. See, Jehoshaphat served the Lord faithfully all his life, but his son, was married in with the family of Ahab. It caused all of his sons except one to be murdered by his son who took the throne, because that's the kind of family you're marrying into, buddy. That's what you chose. You married yourself into some cutthroats. Okay? And so when his son took the throne and his father had provided for all, his father had given him the throne and had set up his other sons in other places. They're not the kings, but we're taking care of them. His son took care of them. He killed them all. That way he could have no rivals. Then was that his wife? I think it was his wife. She ends up killing more of the seed royal. It just causes destruction and devastation for generations to come because Jehoshaphat, a godly man, wedded himself in with the ungodly. If that doesn't scare you, you need to... that is a dangerous, dangerous thing. And so, I think we're... No more time. I really pray that God spoke through this. And hey, the Bible is written for our encouragement. And I know I've talked about a lot of serious, scary stuff. But you know what? You can't read the Bible without that. It just can't. A lot of people do not have the fear of the Lord in our time. And it's because I guess they just read Jesus loves us and wants everybody to love each other. And there's nothing scary in the Bible. And that's just not the way it is. So be sobered by that, but also be encouraged that God can really use your life, and you want to follow Him so that your life has a positive effect and not the negative effects that we see here. So I'm going to pray. We'll dismiss this. There's no invitation or closing song. You want to talk to me after? That's great. But I've already kept you till like 12:04. So, Father, I just thank you.